Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi folks, I'm Jack Kennedy and welcome to Farm Tech Talk, the livestock show. It's the 1st of October, the temperatures have dropped significantly, heralding the arrival of autumn, and there is still plenty happening in the fields. Shout out to our supporters, Ornua, the European Milk Forum, and Grassland Agro for helping us make this happen. In a minute I'm going to talk to Adam, Darren and Aidan, but before that, as per normal, we'll start with the quick fire buzz around, so let's get straight into it. Remember, email your questions to farmtechtalk@farmersjournal.ie or WhatsApp 086-836-6465. Adam, looking at you first, two quick fires here for you. If Adam was farming in Kilkenny, would he buy sucklers or dairy beef heifers? Good land and I work off farm. Adam, straight at you. What's the story? Sucklers? I would like have half an idea what answer you're going to give me, but anyway.
I'd put 50 of the biggest white Charlie cows that I could find, Jack, and I'd live the dream. That's what I'd do. Imagine owning land in Kilkenny. Yeah, that'd be.
Oh my God. He must have known you were going to get that. He was going to get that answer as well. Second question: no sign of my best suckler cow coming in heat. She's calved over 2 months. What should I do?
Yeah, I suppose 2 months, you're getting close to maybe acting on that. Probably a scan, Jack, if you happen to have a couple of cows in maybe and you were unsure of them. A scanner man, it'll tell you, I guess, maybe she could be cystic or sometimes that handling can actually bring them round. So just investigate anyway and see if there's an issue there and that'll tell you from there.
Does she classify as a spring calf or for the suckler guys, or is she
2 months? There's some people maybe summer calf, Jack. That's a new...
Darren, three quick fires for you. When is the real right time to start lambing if I want to get yos and lambs to grass very quick after lambing?
Jack, I'd say it's probably not a case of getting the yos and lambs to grass. It's probably when your grass growth kicks off. So what I'd say is, first of all, basis when your normal grass growth kicks off, having enough of a bank of grass. If your grass growth doesn't kick off till the 1st of April, well, then you shouldn't really be lambing before St. Patrick's Day, because you'll find it hard to fill the void thereafter. Right. So look, it'll vary between every flock, but that's the sort of theory you want to put behind it.
Okay. Second question, are all the lambs sold from Tullamore Farm?
No, sold another batch last week. He's left about 60 or 70. I suppose we have to remember we had a good share of lambs from yearling hoggets and also pet lambs. So he's left with him. But no, going well.
You're making excuses for him. Okay. What does Darren think of the new eco schemes? That's not much of a quick fire. Now, we might touch off that, Darren, in the main show, if that's okay.
Come back to the eco schemes. So.
Is that fair enough? Yeah.
I think so, yeah.
Aidan, I have actually got four quick fires from you. I'm not sure how quick they are. Let's see. I'm not part of my co-op regional advisory committee, but I'd love to know more about the co-op. Where should I start?
It's an interesting one. I suppose to talk to farmers that are on the board, first of all, probably my first port of call, because you know they're the farm representatives. They're running they're the governors of the co-op. They're running it, or they're overseeing the management, I suppose, who are running the co-op. So that's probably the first thing I'd be looking at. Talk to experienced farmers in your area that know more about it. Go to meetings.
Aidan had a piece on extra slurry storage required for dairy cows. Any update on that since?
No. So the Department of Agriculture are saying it'll be December before they're going to give us the updated tables on that.
Okay. Scanning. Hi, Jack. Will you ask Aidan if he has any results coming back yet from scanning? We have 6.5% empty. That's very good, which I'm pleased with, given the year we had with a difficult spring and then heat, stress and drought. I would be interested in seeing how we compare with others. He's doing well, Aidan, at 6.5% empty.
He hasn't told me yet. 6.5% is very good.
Yeah.
Okay, so if it doesn't know what, how many, like, it's still a very good result, you presume, even if it's 14, 15 weeks, it's still a good result. I suppose the target is 12 weeks, and the target is to be under 10%. So, like, no, that farmer is doing well. Look, the range I'm hearing, Jack, is anywhere between 5% and probably 17-18%. So your average is typically in around 10 or 12%. No real difference to normal. But I suppose that's the empty rates, which can be a little bit confusing. It's the 6-week in-calf rate is probably more important. And I am hearing a lot of farmers say that they had a poor conception at the first service. And they're putting that down to the fact that May was quite a difficult month for, you know, weather was wet. It was quite difficult and it was late, you know, there's a late spring. So conceptually, the first service tends to be poor this year than other years. But empty rates are in around normal.
Okay, last question for you. There is so much talk about clover to displace concentrate usage, but it looks to me like no one can tell us how to get clover established without reseeding and how to maintain it in the sward and also keep swards free from weeds. Talk to me, clover. We've touched on this a couple of times.
Yeah. Sort of the questioner says concentrate. Now, it's usually nitrogen is what you'll be, you know, displacing with clover. But clover is a high quality feed, it's a high quality forage, so you can actually reduce your concentrate if you have a lot of clover in your swards. Look, it's very difficult to get clover established, unless you're doing a full reseed. Weeds, I'm not as bothered about the weeds as some people are. Like, you know, DOX is the main thing. The spray, there is a spray available, you know, for the last few years on for killing weeds in grass clover swards. There's a difficulty in sourcing that. Accept that fully. Chaga say that there's other chemistry coming on board, and that even some existing chemistry will be licensed for grass clover swards and reseeds. So the weeds is not a big an issue as it would have been previously thought. We have to grasp, you know, in terms of how we're going to manage it better.
Yeah, perfect. And the cost of fertilizer might make it happen a lot quicker than what might have been expected at the moment. Adam, back to you. I mean, you were down in Tullamore Farm, I presume, on Tuesday night for the farm organization debate in the Tullamore shed. You had good support there from the suckler side. You had ICSA, INHFA, IFA, they were all looking for money for the suckler cow. Did you learn anything from the shed debate?
Look, Jack, I suppose sometimes you'd wonder, maybe having 6 leaders there, and I suppose each of them have their own cohort of farmers that they're representing. But I suppose you come away from it wondering when they head into the Department of Agriculture, into Charlie McConnell, the Minister of Agriculture, to I suppose look for their wares. I can imagine that the minister promising everything to each one of those groups or trying to work with each one of those groups, and you just wonder is there a role for the 6 of those people coming together around a table and say, right, folks, we'll go for this, we'll go for this, and we'll go for this, and would it be an awful lot stronger having someone many more 1,000 farmers behind those 3 key messages? Look, at the chances that happen probably is fairly slim, but you just wonder in terms of all the disjointed messages that was coming through on, I guess, the suckler cow support. That was the only one maybe that a couple of them agreed on. You had different disagreements during the night on what support they wanted.
Yeah, correct. Yeah, you're right. I mean, I'd agree with you to an extent, you know, that definitely it would give the Minister McConnell kind of less get out options, like we say, because if he had the one tune coming into him. The other tune that was singing this week, Adam, on your side, of course, was that whole dairy beef versus suckler debate and Jerry Boyle's comments. And, you know, it took up a large part of the Chagas annual report presentation on Tuesday in terms of where they are now, Chagas, on it and what they said or didn't say. You've done a piece now in terms of what the research says in terms of suckler beef versus dairy beef. And just give us a kind of a flavour for what's in that piece.
Yeah, Jack, I suppose, look, there's been a big fallout from this, and farmers are sort of questioning what research Chagas were using and what research Jerry Boyle was using when he quoted that in that statement that he made about switching to dairy beef production systems. I had a look at the Chagas roadmap. So these are the roadmaps for each sector in terms of heading to 2027. They were published just late in 2020, back in December, so they're pretty fresh. Paul Crossan and Pierce Kelly would have edited the beef ones, and they looked at, I suppose, 3 different systems: a suckler beef system, a dairy beef system 22 months steer, and a dairy beef system 19 months steer. And they've looked at them in both sort of stocking rates, so a low stocking rate and a very, very high stocking rate. Now, the very high stocking rate is up at something like 258 kilos organic, so, or sorry, 250 kilos organic. You're at the absolute maximum in terms of derogation. So I sort of wrote about this week in terms of having those figures for a dairy beef system. You'd question if you're able to run 250 kilos organic, Jack, you probably shouldn't be at a dairy beef system. You probably should be milking cows, to be honest. So I looked at it on a low stocking rate because that's probably more applicable to a lot of beef farms in terms of running on a part-time operation, 1.6, 1.7 livestock units to the hectare. And if we compare those three systems, it's actually suckler beef comes out more profitable than dairy beef systems on a net margin basis. The suckler beef comes out at 274. The dairy beef 22-month steer comes out at 223. This is a hectare. And the dairy beef 19-month heifer comes out at 231. And there's another little sort of caveat in that concentrates required per livestock unit is 360 kilos in the suckler beef system. It's 930 in the steer dairy and it's 795 in the 19-month heifer beef. And you know, you just wonder then what research Jerry Boyle was referring to when he said about, based on research, he was strongly advocating the switch to dairy beef production. Because if we look at Chagas's own research, that's not saying that.
And I suppose there has been a significant rollback from by Chagas and an apology for the offence and for all of that, and saying that Chagas and, you know, the chairman came out with it and the new director, Frank O'Mara, came out with it again, that there is a place for the suckler cow. Like, I mean, can you hear that now? Like, you know what I mean? Despite what kind of was said previously, like, I mean, can you,
Jack, but I suppose we spoke to some of the beef stakeholders this week and they haven't had a response from Chagas on the questions that they asked them in terms of what was the policy. There's no formal response to those stakeholders and they're not that happy about that, to be honest. They sent a letter to the chairman, Liam Herlihy, and he hasn't come back to them. So I'm not too sure where this is going to go, to be honest. I think maybe Chagas have to respond. I'd feel that they'd have to respond back. It might be only, you know, good practice to respond back to those. If they think anything of those beef stakeholders at all, they will respond to them.
Now, and again, related to this, Adam, of course, is your piece there on the suckler cow numbers in terms of actually where they're going, you know, because like there is a piece happening and has been happening for the last number of years in terms of suckler cow numbers declining. Like, so whether they're listening to Jerry Boyle or not, farmers are going to do their own thing to a large extent anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. We've seen the biggest drop, Jack. One of the biggest drops in the last 10 years in suckler cow numbers on the June census from the Central Statistics Office. We're back by 43,000. It's a 4.4% drop on the previous year. I guess part of that is BDGP, I'd say, in terms of BDGP probably had a stabilising effect to the national suckler herd from 15 to 20. Some farmers didn't opt for the extra year in BDGP in 2021, so we've seen a drop off. Now, whether that'll continue, I guess there's a lot of uncertainty around the sector at the moment. In contrast to that, dairy cow numbers are obviously growing. I think it's up 36,000 up to 1.6 million, going in the opposite direction to suckler cow numbers. So there's questions there around that whole, look, we've discussed this already, but the cap on suckler cow numbers, did the government need to bring in that if this was going to happen anyway? I'm not too sure.
Okay, we'll touch off it again, no doubt, in the coming weeks. Adam, couple of quick ones. The beef markets, kind of what's happening? Any change that happened around the world that we need to know about?
No, it's pretty steady, Jack, I guess. You know, the Irish price is sort of around that 415, 425 for steers or bullocks, 420 to 430 for heifers. UK still going very, very strong. There's issues over there with CO2 and CO2 gas supply in terms of using that to extend the shelf life of meat. It's not affecting us here. It might be actually having a little bit of a positive impact here in terms of us shifting beef over there. In terms of world markets, we've done a little roundabout trip round on beef trends this week, looking Australia, they're probably capitalising on that Brazilian ban going into China. They're probably pushing beef into China. US price is up as well, and that's going into Japan and wider Asia. So around the world, everywhere is going pretty good, Jack, except for Brazil. Brazil has seen a bit of price negativity and a price coming back because of that ban going into China. To be honest, I thought that would be opened up by this stage going into China, but it hasn't. It's pretty positive. I know, looking at our own figures, we're down 62,000 stock ahead on 2020 levels in terms of slaughtering levels. But yet, the kill is still pretty high at 36,000, but I expect that to tighten more come to the end of the year.
And we're not too worried about Brazil. They had a record price anyway. I think they were coming up on very big prices anyway. So a little bit of a pigback is not is not the end of the world for them. I mean, the weaning trade is flying at that, which you would nearly expect, Adam, wouldn't you, given kind of prices where they are and the kind of, you know, are you putting that at a 5-year high?
Yeah, 5-year high. That's our front page story this week, Jack. Looking at, you know, €3 a kilo there for that sort of 350 kilo weanling, which is a really good, really good price. We're also seeing a gap opening up, a big, big gap opening up between the top third and the bottom third of weanlings within that Markbids database. You know, you're looking at €300 now of a difference between a bottom third and a top third. And, you know, maybe you'd sit back and you'd say, gosh, if suckler cow numbers decline more, will that gap open up more? Will those good cattle be even more scarce? And will people be prepared to pay more for them? So really interesting analysis from Shane Murphy this week. He has 2 pages going into a lot of breeds and a lot of weights. It's really interesting stuff from Markbids. Yeah.
Nice one. Last one for you, the autumn breeding focus. You have a good few pieces there in terms of, I suppose, autumn breeding do's and do nots and AI and stock wool, etc., and that kind of thing.
Yeah, and Declan Maron has taken a look at nutrition. I suppose it's really, really important. I suppose when a cow goes out in spring after she calves, nature tends to look after her in terms of grass supply and on the suckler side of the house, and she generally goes back and calf. But on an autumn calving situation, it's a little bit different, and you need really good quality silage. And if you haven't got that, you have to go in with concentrates. That's going to be expensive this year because obviously concentrate prices are up, but we can't skimp on that or we won't have cows in calf. Kieran Milley has looked at AI versus stock bulls. So yeah, some lovely stuff there in the focus this week, focusing in on autumn calving.
Thanks, Adam. I didn't know you brought your suckler cows in. But anyway, that's a day for another battle for another day. Thanks, Adam. Chat to you next week. Darren, you were up on a hill sheep farm in, you have a nice report there from a hill sheep farm up in County Antrim. If I'm reading it right, Darren, he's scanning 1.57. That's nearly as good as what you're doing in Tullamore on a lowland flock, is it?
Look, it would leave aside last year in Tullamore, Jack. Sorry, Will, you're picking holes in Adam all day, and now you're going out for Sean again a second time. So he won't want to watch Farm TikTok at all this week.
I know he's probably given up on us, but 1.57 for a hill sheep flock is a great scan, isn't it? Like, in fairness.
Look at Jack, yeah. Darren McLeish is the farmer. He's part of the Northern Ireland sheep program. And like Dermot would say himself, he's possibly gone too far for his system. And look, part of it is, Jack, I suppose, it's his whole area management, the whole area, I suppose, of the type of yaw that he's been looking at. And I remember visiting Dermot's farm when we were, say, going around picking the farmers for it, and his father, Patsy or Patrick, took out a book, and he could record the breeding data going back about 35 years into a hand record. So look at...
No ICBF needed there,
No, exactly. So, like, this isn't... It's not just something that happened overnight, but in the last few years, one of the things I suppose that has really driven it is around the nutrition around the yaw. And he's been, say, he was running around 400, say, Scotch yaws on a hard hill, and that was probably keeping his scanning rate about 1.1, 1.15. He takes the 100, say, oldest yaws off the hill now, brings them down onto lowland, he gets access to winter grazing. He puts them on say there. It also frees up a bit of grass, say then he's a bit of lower, say, ground, I suppose maybe semi-improved sort of hill ground, where he brings the other 300 yaws down 2 weeks in advance of breeding, whereas before that he would have just brought them down at a pint of breeding.
Yeah.
And all of them things, I suppose, combined is giving him a good boost in his scanning rate. Yeah. And then around feeding, I suppose, in early sort of pregnancy as well, he's not having that early embryo loss. And all of them things together has developed or has driven it to that. Like, he was about 1.46, I think, 2 years ago, then went to 1.51 and then 1.57. And as he said himself, look, that's where he wants to sort of stay, because his issue now is that hard hill isn't good enough to take back up his yaws, rear and twin lambs. And it's putting pressure on the number of sheep then he has in his upland and lowland ground. So it's about trying to find that, I suppose, maybe happy medium or trying to find that balance. But it just, I suppose, for me, Jack, the message is that Scottish blackface yaw, Chagas research has shown it, Caffrey research has shown it, that is very responsive to live rate and nutrition in the run-up to breeding. So if you can get the two of them things right, they can return in regards litter size to you. And that goes from a farmer going from 0.8 of a scanning rate to 1, or in Dermot's case, going from 1.1, 1.2 to, over the last few years, going to 1.5 lambs.
Darren, I mean, we've often talked about the extra productivity on these hill lambs that the farmers didn't want it, you know, in terms of there's a problem when there's too many lambs because you have to mind them a bit more, etc., and that kind of thing. Maybe not a problem, but it's more of a challenge, like we'll say, to mind the extra lambs. Like, I mean, but with the price of lamb where it's gone now, I mean, is that less of a challenge in that you're going to get a reward and a return for the work that you put in kind of around that lamb in time?
Definitely, but it's only one side of it. Because the other element that Dermot would say is that if he keeps too many ewes down off the hill, just say a bit of ground came up and he has access to a bit of low-lying ground and he takes it. He said his issue then is keeping the hill in what we term good agricultural and environmental condition. Because if he's not putting back up, say, these 250, 300 ewes with lambs, the hill will start getting strong and then it'll affect, say, I suppose, the performance. And it'll be cumulative in this.
Yeah.
The hill will degrade over time, but also then it'll have an impact on direct payment. So there is that sort of happy balance of what you have to try and achieve. And the one thing where I suppose research is showing as well is that if you get some of them ewes maybe accustomed to a better doing, that they won't actually be happy then on the hill. That We're doing, say, a bit of judging on that MSD program. And we have one farmer in there this week, Martin Hopkins from over in Westport. And he's on a very, very difficult hill. And he's not bringing in any feed at all because he said the hill is so difficult. Now, his aim is to try and get somewhere between 0.9 and one lamb. So I suppose it's chalk and cheese when you're talking about Dermot system.
Yeah.
But he doesn't want to bring in any inputs at all because the hill is that sort, I suppose, maybe severe in this. If you always get accustomed to it over time or get accustomed to supplementary feeding, they're going to go the other way. And his aim is to just regenerate the females and have the male lambs to sell.
Okay, treat them mean and keep them keen. Soil sample program, Darren, talk to me in terms of, that was, am I right in terms of that, that was opened, that was launched, which was launched a couple of weeks ago, but was opened for farmers to apply this week?
Yeah, open on Monday, Jack, and there must have been quite a cohort written, sitting, waiting for it to open. I suppose, look, at one of the elements of it was, it was seen as a first-come, first-served basis. So there's three things that's going to, I suppose, maybe determine it. One is they want a good geographical spread. The next thing is they want a good spread across enterprises, so across tillage and all the different livestock enterprises. And then the last element was first-come, first-served basis. And we've really seen that drive home. The first, I suppose, 2 days, up to 6 o'clock on Tuesday evening, there was 4,500 applications in first. So I think a lot more than even the department expected. Now, a question we're getting, Jack, is am I wasting my time now putting in an application? The closing date is Friday, the 8th of October. Mm-hmm. And what I'd say to anyone is, Ginny, no, because look, we've seen what happened on the REAP scheme and we talked about it here with farmers saying, should I apply? I don't have maybe a huge amount of pints. And the department were able to go and get extra funds and increase from 3,000 farmers to 5,000 farmers. There's nothing to say that may not happen again. So it takes about, I'd say, 5 minutes, Jack, going from logging in to putting in your application. So if a farmer is interested, you've absolutely nothing to lose by doing it.
Go for it, get the application in, and they say it's a simple enough job to do. Last one, Darren, for you. I mean, grass growth, well, particularly down around me here, has been very good, like in the last couple of weeks. And my sheep buddy said to me, like, he says, jeepers, he says, some of my paddocks have gone too strong. He says, the sheep will never get in under it. You know, the kind of way he says, I'd need cattle going in with them as well to have any kind of an impact on the paddock. Like, you know, in terms of grazing heavy covers, is it a problem for you guys?
Yeah, Jack, it is. Like, and look, I was talking to Phil Creighton in Jogas this week around the closing dates and sort of altering them. And look, I suppose, It's a nice place to be in. Like at an I grew 85 kilos of grass last week. Like that's for this day of the year. Like it just shows this, I suppose, they weren't getting the rainfall levels, but the moisture was still good. And they put out the final application, I think it was 20 or 22 units of nitrogen, and it just responded. Like Phil was saying, that he has a lot of heavy covers over there now, as a lot of farmers. I think you could draw a line, or you could probably say most of the country, but take out some places in Carlow, Kilkenny, Wexford, that just didn't get that boost. Aidan will probably look at the same thing.
Yeah.
But outside of that, you're probably seeing a lot of covers, even 2,200, 2,500. If it wasn't so late in the year, you'd be telling farmers to come in and whip them out. To me, look, it's not the worst thing in the world. I'd prefer to have it than go looking for it. And it just comes down to management then, is that it depends on what cycle of your flock is in. If you're in the run-up to breeding, you don't want, I suppose, maybe punish yours too much. So if they're going into a very heavy cover, what I'd be saying is go in, let them graze off, say the leafy part, and don't force them to graze it down, say, or to clean out the sward altogether. The ideal situation, Jack, would be to go in 2 or 3 day blocks, split it up in this. You can afford in for the yours to graze hair, graze the leafy sort of, I suppose, maybe material for sort of 36 hours, and then force them to graze down the lower value material for another 36. It won't impact their performance because they're going into leafy grass again. But that's not a runner for, I suppose, maybe a lot of farms. So the happy medium is to try and go in, get a grazing off it, let it freshen up and then come again, while also being cognizant of that you're only 3 or 4 weeks away from closing your first paddocks for a March lambing flock. So like Phil's research and that, and I would show that you want to have 20% of the farm closed by the end of October for a March lambing flock to have enough grass coming on stream. So I think that's the balance that you have to try and achieve. And the other element that you have to take into account is for lambs that are going on them very heavy covers, the performance on that won't be as good as what you think, unless you just let them graze off the leafy material and move them on then again.
Yeah.
Once they take that nice top bite off, they're into lower sort of value material.
Yeah.
And look, at that grass will be a great reserve for the next 2 months, but it's just how to manage it now that you set yourself up okay.
I mean, Darren, last one, that closing date and that closing cover, like, it must be one of the big areas where your guys fall down, because it's so easy to leave sheep out, like, you know what I mean? Because they're not doing a whole lot of damage, you know, the kind of a way, like, and, you know, the majority of sheep lads want to see them out rather than inside in the shed, like.
Oh, sure, Jack, true, like, and this year there's a temptation with the grass covers that's there to say, sure, I'm elected, I'll graze on again. And like, the big risk is to let them graze over all of the, say, productive material without actually cleaning out Anton, because you'll struggle to come back in then, because some of them heavy covers on the sheep side of things is that the grass sort of gets tainted, particularly if weather goes, I suppose, turns. And we have got quite, I suppose, a nice bit of rain. So it's to graze a bit, let it freshen up, and then come in and clean it out again. But like, definitely, look, it's a big risk on sheep lambs.
Darren, before I leave you go, I mean, eco schemes and that whole piece around the cap, it came up very much in the webinar with the farm organizations on Tuesday night. But we have more details now on the eco schemes and maybe what way they might look like. And I suppose there was a general feeling from the farm organizations that there's going to be more costs involved in the eco schemes that they weren't necessarily looking for.
Yeah, Jack, definitely. I'd say, look, the department had a meeting last week with farm organizations, the CAP consultative committee, and they have 5 measures put across. Now, look, I think it's important to say that this is proposals at the beginning. I imagine the farm orgs are probably pushing to get a few more measures added to that, because the measures, I suppose, in particular for dairy and tillage, are probably a bit scant. So the first measure, I suppose, is around the whole area, Jack, of extensive livestock production. What the department have said is that they're setting that sort of, or what I suppose maybe the discussions at the meeting were, that that'd be around 85 kilos of organic nitrogen would be the upper limit. There'd be a minimum limit, which would be somewhere along the lines of, say, the A and C.
Right.
Looking at, say, I suppose, a cross-representative sample, Jack, you'd probably bring in about 50,000 to 60,000 farmers in that, say, one there. The other one, is to say the GAEC, or it's trying to increase the, I suppose, the non-productive areas. And I suppose the devil will be in the detail on this, because that's probably one that would suit, say, a lot of your more extensive sheep or beef farmers. It may suit some dairy and some tillage farmers, depending on what way hedgerows are counted, or maybe buffer strips or ecological focus areas. I think that'll be determinant on that, like, and even around the logistics of counting up hedgerows, or even sort of seeing what's there at the moment. But I think, look, there needs to be, I suppose, a more on that. But that's probably one that sheep and beef farmers would say on the face of it, that probably they'd be happy you should enough on. The other one, Dinjack, I suppose, is one that's probably targeted a dairy around the whole sort of limit on chemical nitrogen usage. And I'd say that's probably dairy and tillage is probably what they're targeting more so. And look, there will be a cost to that. Look, at some farmers have said, and you've commented before with Aidan, that maybe the increase in fertilizer will look after some of that on its own. But it's how much of a limit is put in. And the other big question mark at the minute is that would probably have to be linked into this fertilizer register. And whether or not that's going to be up and running and available by the start of 2023, I'm not just so sure. Look, maybe you will be, Jack, but like that's probably a big job of work to get that up. There's two more then. One is around tree planting. What they said is two trees per eligible hectare per year. So these eco schemes are voluntary. Say 64 euros a hectare is where the sort of payment is asked. The department have said you have to take two measures. So it's running around 32 euros a hectare. So you'd have to, out of that 32 euros a hectare, you have to plant two trees for that. Okay. The general soundings is that you can plant them maybe in a grove or in a, say, line, a tree lined. But it'll depend on then whether there's measures around how, say, far apart they have to be, whether they all have to be individually fenced. That sort of thing is what runs into cost. Like, because if you take, just say, a dairy farmer, 80 hectares, that's 160 trees over 5 years. It's 900 trees. Like, so it's not insignificant. It might seem insignificant, two trees per hectare, but longer term, there is something. And the last one then is around GPS, spreading fertilizer with GPS. And I think that's targeted at trying to increase the efficiency. And look at that. Realistically, you'd probably have to say again that it's probably tillage and dairy farmers, because with a GPS spreader costing somewhere between 22,000 and 30,000, and I might be even conservative that Peter Thomas Keaveney might tell me they're 40,000, but that's, I suppose, maybe entry level ones. It's probably something that some farmers would use. Look, at contractors could be an option, or maybe two or three farmers could come together and buy it, but that would have to be allowed. So it's good to see, I suppose, maybe the elements coming out ahead of the next consultation. But we do need more information on it.
Yeah. The other one on the trees, Darren, of course, is that piece, you know, where Minister McConnell was saying that, you know, that farmers won't own the carbon rights to it, you know. So, I mean, that'll have to be straightened out, I'd say, before many farmers will start planting another tree or two.
Oh, definitely, Jack. Like, and look, at that whole debate opens up, say, a whole other debate. Like, if you look at the REAP scheme, and if you want to take it to the nth degree, is that, would you say that if a farmer has been paid to or being compensated to increase the biodiversity and that improves the carbon in that area, like, to me, that's going to be a landmark around the tree side of things, because Jeannie, if that goes ahead, farmers will be very reluctant to sign up to any scheme which they think could undermine their position going forward.
Absolutely. If you can't trade the entitlement, or if you can't retrofit, if you can't, it will definitely, there'll be no incentive there for the farmer to try and do it. Like, you know, so I think that'll have to be sorted before some of those things go on. Darren, thanks for that. Talk to you next week. Aidan, the grass supply and what's happening around the country. I mean, it's as Darren said, it varies. There's pockets in the east that definitely, I suppose, suffered a little bit with drought. And I know dairy farmers will say they're having to buy silage and have been feeding silage all summer. Like, is there many in that kind of bracket, we'll say, that are many of your guys that are tight on grass supply, we'll say, in the east?
Yeah, anyway, I've spoken to Jack. They've kind of come out of it at this stage. Like, the rain has kind of come, and they're no longer in drought scenario, let's say, but they mightn't have hit their peak average farm cover that they would normally do. But, and they've had to feed a lot of meal just to hold what they've had, and silage as well. But they're out of it now. But it's generally small numbers, I would think, Jack. Like, I mean, the majority dairy farmers are okay. But Darren is right. Like, there's a pocket there. There's a corridor running across the country, we'd say, from Dublin down to maybe parts of Kilkenny. and in that area there, in that corridor there, there wasn't much rain came in August or early September, and as a result then they couldn't build the covers that they normally would have. But like, yeah, south and north of that and west and east, you know, it's super, like it's absolutely fantastic. Yeah. Most farmers are way above in terms of where they need to be in terms of average farm cover.
If they got wet weather now, Aidan, it might kind of make it more difficult quicker than normal.
Yeah, but at the same time, most farmers are at their target level. And I mean, if you're on dry ground, it's everything is bonus territory from now on, because ground is good currently. Often we get a very wet September, Jack, and we'd be very, you know, things will be very sticky into October. That's not the case now. Okay, look, those on the west and on heavier soils, there's always a risk there. But look, I mean, if they don't have the grass, they definitely wouldn't be grazing it. So like they have a good opportunity now, you'd say that. The forecast isn't great, but it's not that bad either. There's rain coming most days. Look, the issue, Jack, is there's no drying from now on. Like, the daylight hours are closing in. There's very little drying. So, like, you're just going to cope with it. But sure, look, there's only 6 weeks left of grazing anyway, Jack, even best case scenario. So, look what we are. Like, I don't think it's too bad.
Just to touch again off the soil sampling piece, I touched off it with Darren. Like, will many of your guys apply for that, do you reckon?
I'd say they will, yeah. There's a growing interest in the soil carbon thing. And then anyway, even aside of that, like there's a growing interest in the, you know, well, like the number of soil samples going into labs in Ireland has increased dramatically over the last few years, due in mainly part to, you know, a bigger drive in terms of sustainability. It's something we're preaching the whole time. Chagas are preaching it. But the big driver there, Jack, will be the higher fertilizer prices. So, you know, if your pH levels aren't adequate, you're not going to get your nitrogen, your organic nitrogen moving in the soil, generating, you know, getting the soil microbes working and all that kind of stuff that's going to make everything else more available. So a lot of farmers are going to be, rather than spreading a load of can next year, they'll probably spread a few more loads of lime. But you need to know where to target that. And the only way to know that is by soil sampling. So I'd say you're going to see an increase in soil sampling this year anyway.
Yeah, a good few lads around me here actually are actually spreading lime this weekend, and even on grass with a little bit of cover. Like, it's, you know, I mean, it's the longer rotation, you're giving it a chance, and mixed weather kind of helping, you know, wash it in.
Yeah, but if there's a bit of rain coming afterwards, it'd be always nice just to wash it in, so it stays off the leaf. But the next few weeks, we're going to see a lot of lime spread, a lot of slurry spread as well. And just, it's important to remember, like, go with the slurry first and then go with the lime, just to make the nitrogen more available in the slurry.
Yeah. Aidan, you've a nice piece. You obviously were asking farmers at Moor Park Open Day what was going on and getting their views on things. You've a kind of a survey piece done. You have a lot of charts and different questions. Maybe give us a flavour for someone that maybe hasn't bought the journal yet. Just give us a flavour of kind of some of the results and where it's at.
Yeah, so we the team, I suppose the Farmers Journal team, surveyed or polled 400 farmers in Moor Park, which is about 2.5% of all dairy farmers. So it's actually a very reflective, comprehensive survey, representative of the population at large. And I suppose a couple of headline figures, 2/3 of dairy farmers reckon they'll have to cut back on chemical nitrogen in terms of, you know, for the new nitrates proposals that are coming through. 2/3 say that they'd have to build extra slurry storage or soil water storage in order to comply with the new measures that are proposed in the nitrates. So there, you know, they're big. That's big change that's going to happen. All in terms of improving their environmental footprint. Interestingly, over half, 55%, say that they intend to expand cow numbers over the next 5 years. So that's it's a 5-year program. It's not all going to happen next year or the year after. But the vast majority, 70% or something like that, of them intend to go no more than 30%, like, so up between, you know, 1% and 30%, with the vast majority going between 10% and 20%. So, like, you know, there is still an appetite there for expansion. Now, whether they be allowed to expand or not, Jack, is a different story. Like, you know, we've issues over processing capacity, particularly with Glanbia, and like the government is to publish its climate budgets in the next few weeks or next few months. So that's going to determine a lot too, whether we're be allowed to expand or not.
Aidan, the slurry one we've touched off before. I mean, there's definitely a lot of you know, farmers that have increased cow numbers, have done a new milking parlour, maybe wanted to do a calf shed, and then we're going to go at slurry storage, etc., that kind of thing. Like, it's, they're going to have to probably bring forward the slurry storage piece definitely to kind of get that sorted sooner rather than later.
Yeah, but the interesting thing there, Jack, is that so 80% say that they have enough slurry storage to comply with existing rules. Now, the wording of that question was, do you need to spread slurry during the closed period? And 80% said they don't. Now, there's a slight tweak there in the sense that if you're in zone A, you actually need to have 16 weeks of storage, but the close period is for 12 weeks. So the department have come out to say 40% of dairy farmers that they've inspected don't have enough slurry storage, but that's not to say 40% are having to spread slurry during the close period either. So there's a little bit of, you know, there's a little bit of playing with words there, maybe from the department side. But you're right in what you're saying, in the sense that if you are short, I mean, are you expanding and you haven't got the storage in place for the extra cows that you're planning to bring on? Are you going to do it and put in the long finger? I mean, definitely you need to front storage now needs to be as important, we say, as the cubicle space or the units in the milking parlor, the roadways, the water and fencing and all the rest, because it's really critical for, I suppose, our license to produce milk. If you're seen to be spreading slurry now during the close period, I don't think your fellow farmers, your neighbours, let alone environmentalists, are going to have any time for that. So I think it's a key measure.
The other piece, and of course, the big change that you kind of in the last couple of weeks that's happening is the kind of the cost of ag fertilizer, the cost of artificial fertilizer has gone up significantly and looks like it's going to stay up, and at least in the short term until we get a couple of things sorted out. So the value of slurry has gone up as well then as a result, you know.
Yeah, big time. And also the value then of your training shoes and your dribble bars that are going to make that nitrogen more available again has also improved, you know. So, I mean, definitely, like the value that's there in slurry has to be recognized. And spreading it in a kind of a fire brigade action because you haven't enough space to store any more of it, whether that's, you know, the close period, which is a definite no-no, or even in early January middle of January when you're allowed to spread in zone A and zone B, you definitely say maybe you're better off to hold that until you know end of February, the first week of March, when you've got out with the bag stuff anyway and spread the slurry instead with a trailing shoe or dribble bar. You know, you're going to get a way more bang for your buck in that case. But the issue is on most farms that they just need to spread earlier because the slurry storage is tight.
Yeah, last one, Aidan, and it was one of the questions on the kind of the quickfire job, scanning, and it's in terms of, I suppose, moving on or off cows, we'll say, that are empty, etc., and that kind of thing. Is it still early days in terms of the kind of moving off, or have guys really started now kind of tighten up on stock numbers to allow kind of a little bit of an extra grazing and take the pressure off for kind of the last 6 or 8 weeks?
Well, you'd say up to last weekend, probably, Jack, like until the rain came. It was very much, you know, everyone was holding on to all the cows, whether they're empty or not, because there's plenty of grass around, obviously, you know, in most farms, that, with the exclusion of those that were suffering from drought. But in most farms, there's loads of grass there. Cows are generally milking very well, and so they've held on to them. But there is a big demand there. Darren will tell you that, and Adam will tell you that there's a big demand for all types of stock. And you're seeing now that cows that are empty, but still in milk, are actually commanding a premium price. There's farms getting up to €1,000 for some of them, you know, if they're decent frame and they're milking well, and they'll turn into a good beef animal at the end of the day as well. They're, you know, it's a big demand for them, and even all types of stock, all types of dairy stock, there's a good demand for. So I'd say now, Jack, over the next week or 10 days, you're going to see an off that more cows moving. Like, even I've heard two or three people talking about it in the last few days where nobody mentioned it at all for the last month, and normally, like, come September, they'll be talking about selling under empties, but it's everything is delayed this year because the weather has been good and grass growths have been plentiful.
Yeah, excellent. Aidan, 100%, leave it at that. Chat to you next week. Earlier, I had another chat in our NDC Kerrygold Quality Milk Awards series. Let's have a listen.
Yeah, well, I'm farming there in partnership with my wife, and she had a full-time job, but now she's farming full-time with me. And sure, Carmen does all the paperwork and lets me do all the outside work, and she helps in milking and looking after the calves and all that. And then John, he's the eldest, he's 20, he's nearly 21 in a few weeks' time. And he's in third year in WIT in Waterford doing ag science. And sure, he's available, whenever he's available, he helps too.
Yeah.
And then Brian is doing the leaving cert, so he won't be around quite as much this year, and sure, hopefully he'll be going to college after that. And then Arl is in transition year.
Yeah.
And sure, she's available as well. But they all help out.
But and that's kind of maybe where I was coming from. Exactly. They all dig in, they all kind of are up to speed, and they all, I'll say, you know, I was only there for a short time, but they all like it, Pat, I'd say.
Oh, they do, yeah. Well, John will be the one now that would have the most interest in it. With everything, cows and machinery and he'd have the most interest in it.
The full gamble.
Arla would be very interested too. She wants to pursue some career in science, maybe a vet or something. That's where she's heading for anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
And Brian wouldn't be quite as much into it now, but he do help out and milk and all like that. But
yeah,
it's more kind of computers and stuff he'd be into.
And Pat, again, kind of coming back to kind of what we learned on the day, like, I mean, there's a strong history of, I suppose, of breeding and cows in, you know, in your family. And like, I mean, we heard about, you know, the generation prior to your generation in terms of their involvement as well. Like, I mean, it's not, you know, we went through kind of three generations of Banvilles in terms of for Ireland Inc. it's kind of maybe normal enough, but for a lot of others outside of Ireland, they don't realize that kind of traditional, that inheritance piece that happens on a lot of Irish
families. My grandfather came from Asagar, which would be only up the road, about 5 kilometers away, and he married a woman called Jane Whihey. And she had only a small bit of land, but the farm that he came from, there was a good few brothers and a couple of sisters in it. And so at that time, the only option you had was kind of get a job or leave the country or maybe marry into a farm. That was the only way of getting land. And he married in, but the older generation would say he was a super stock man. He could do things that vets are probably, like, I was talking to a fella last night, and he was talking about, they were pumping, they had to pump cows back 80 years ago. You know, they knew how to do it. They were just super. Yeah. My father, the same way. He was unbelievable how to do it with stock, you know. Everything, calving cows. If a vet came to our yard, even still, if I called the vet knew he was going to have a job. You know, it wasn't going to be simple.
Yeah, it's very serious, as you say, at that stage. Like, yeah, they had the skills of the real stock persons at the time. They weren't people
managers. They had the skills,
yeah. You know, yeah. Like, I mean, but you know, that, I mean, that piece and tradition really came through very strong kind of on your farm. Now, I mean, you have, Pat, it's fair to say you have a keen interest in cows, in breeding, in pedigrees, maybe not hugely on the showing side of things, but you definitely have it in terms of breeding and kind of wanting that kind of nice Frisian cow, like.
Yeah, well, you know, a lot of people think, like, if you have a pedigree Holstein Friesian herd, you have the extreme. Mine are not extreme. They're a grass-based cow, a cow not too tall, you know, produce a good calf. I'd always try to breed for excellent feet and excellent udders. That's why I'd be, you know, excellent legs.
Yeah.
Cows that can walk around, good udders, good teeth placement. That's why, and a high EBI. That's why but I'd always use pedigree bulls, because, you know, when you have a pedigree herd, you like to try keeping pedigree.
Yeah.
But they're not. They're a grass cow for a grass based system. That's the type of cow I'm breeding.
Yeah, they are. I mean, grass is still very, and you can grow plenty of it. You're lucky enough to be situated, as you in time, just outside time on in Wexford. You can grow plenty of grass. In fairness, like, you know.
Oh, we would. We'd be out early. And even after the 25th of January, if the weather was right, and we'd cows calve, to be going out. That's to be staying out to. Into November, you know.
Correct. Yeah. No, you've a long year at grass. I mean, Pat, the one piece that I'll say, and that stood out for me in terms of your visit, was that whole piece around kind of the environment and how you've changed or adapted a couple of key things around the farm to kind of, I suppose, manage that kind of. Just talk to us about your farm in terms of you have a stream running through it. We'll say it's a tributary of a bigger river, and I suppose there's a lot of measurement goes on that river in terms of measuring it for nutrients and kind of for pollution, etc. And that kind of thing. So you have to be ultra conscious of it, we'll say, on your farm.
We're always aware of that stream. That stream actually flows into, well, obviously is part of a tributary of the Corrock River, which would be a bigger river, but that stream went to a pumping station, which would have put water into the village to Mun. So we were always aware of that stream. And when I came back here in 1990, we stopped the cows from entering the stream, and, you know, and we would have been very aware of it all the time.
Yeah.
And then this year, sure, we've done a lot of work on the roadways. We knew the regulations were coming, so we cambered the roadway away from the bank of the stream, and we shifted the wires out from the banks at the edge of the river. And you've seen yourself there, we put the ESB poles put down just to kind of rise the filling along with the edge of the bank to just stop hanging from getting into it.
Yeah,
it's working well now.
And that's it. I mean, it's small and simple stuff, but it's very effective in terms of your positioning, because like there's a kind of I call it a slope down on the farm roadway, we'll say, down towards the stream. And you can see if there was very heavy rain that, listen, there was going to be a flow down the farm roadway and it was going to get into the stream, but you've diverted that kind of away from the stream effectively. Isn't that what you've done? Like?
Yeah, well, it would be falling from both sides of the land.
Yeah,
the stream would be in the lowest point of, and you come down when you're walking from the farmyard, the fall is to the stream, and when you come to the stream up the other direction with the cow roadway, the fall is coming to the stream as well. So
yeah,
you know, if you didn't get a lot of that water off the roadway, it was going to go into the stream. There's no doubt there would go into it.
Yeah, it was. And okay, albeit as you say, cows are kind of they're not standing on the farm roadway for long. They're passing through. But I mean, nevertheless, you can see that there would be a lot of nutrients at times deposited on the farm roadway, and that it was potentially going to get into the stream. Like, I mean, if you went back, we talked about kind of going back to the generations there earlier on, but I mean, if you went back 80 years ago, the cows were probably walking through the stream or walking to, if they were getting to a piece of land, like they were traveling through it. Like, I mean, there's none of that happening now. Like,
no, they probably, and I don't remember the bridge would have been put there in the 70s, but probably originally there was no bridge there. They would have walked straight across it,
I guarantee you.
Straight across it, even with the bridge there, actually there's two bridges there. You know, that alone would have been a huge help.
It would, exactly. Yeah. And sometimes with streams and rivers, we talk about kind of the problem of pollution or nutrients getting in. But the other piece is when the cows are actually walking in the streams, that they're upsetting the river bed, we'll say, which is crucial to it. So there's none of that going on now, we'll say. The nutrients are stopped from going into the stream and the cows are not walking through the river bed. So, like, I mean, you're doing your best. And I did one of your relations, Pat, do a little bit of a test on the,
yeah,
on the river?
Yeah, a nephew of mine, Ian Blake, he'd done... for his ag science project, he done a kick test on the stream just to see what invertebrates were in the stream, you know. Sure. And they're minute, like, you see the things you take up. When I was with him when he was doing it, you'd kick the bed of the river and they had flow into the net, special net for it. And you think it was only a little bit, you know, like looking like gravel, you'd say. Ah. But when you go through it, the little things you'd find in it, you know. Mayfly, all these little things, like, you'd never know, but they're actually in the bed of the river.
That's it, and that's where they live, and that's one of the big problems where you have a large number of cows walking through rivers, is you're destroying their home, we'll say, I call it, like, you know what I mean, like that's,
yeah.
and that's one of the pieces, definitely. So I mean, look at we were very impressed in that side of things. I mean, the other piece, I suppose, from your farm is, like, in terms of the facilities, Pat, and you've a lot done, but you were talking about doing a little bit more even as well in terms of cubicles and slurry storage. Like, I mean, you have evolved as kind of, I suppose, the farm has evolved.
Yeah, well, we'd be always trying to improve, you know. So I always say, the day you're not improving, you're going backwards. That'd be my opinion. And the day you were there, we're talking about putting in a tank in an existing shed. We have that done there now at the moment. We've done it there about a month ago. Yeah. And we're at that now at the moment. But we have a bigger job when John comes back here, hopefully in a couple of years. We're planning on covering an open slurry pit and putting another 60 cubicles on that. And so when we do that, we'll create more cubicle space, but we'll also stop the overhead water from entering the, you know, you could have 2 foot of water fall out of the sky in the winter and fill in tanks. Like, we'll eliminate that as well. So killing two birds with one stone.
No, it's constantly evolving. Like, I mean, look at it. I mean, call a spade a spade. Your quality was top notch. I mean, Pat, as you know, that was that's the ticket into this competition. Like, and I mean, is it still good? Even, you know, have you had a good year in 2021, Pat? Like, we'll say, we were looking.
I said the day you were there, I said that the TBC had gone up a little bit. Had gone up to, I think, 12 or 14 the day you were there, but there was an issue with the hot water system. I couldn't get the little control box for setting it had got wet.
Yeah.
There wouldn't be a washing there before you came, and it got wet and it wouldn't change past 35 degrees.
Yeah.
And within a couple of weeks, the TBC had gone up that much, and the Vermeer I got fixed and got the water back up to 80, that went back down to 2. Shit. That'll tell you about the hot water. Back it's down home. To 2, the next collection then.
Yeah, that's how important it is. Like,
No, everything else would have been the same amount of detergent, just the lack of water what was causing it.
Yeah. Yeah. Pat, since we were on the farm, we had the day in Moorpark at the open day in terms of, I suppose, just kind of gathering all the finalists, etc., and that kind of thing. Like, I mean, did you learn anything from that day, or did you kind of, I mean, did you get talking to any of the farmers, or kind of what kind of did you take from it? Kind of, I suppose, you know, because that was your first time meeting a lot of those farmers, and it was the first time kind of meeting a lot of us. You know, I mean, it was good to meet up, I suppose, in the current environment anyway, with COVID and the way.
Oh, yeah, sure, it was great day. And great to be able to have it that day in Moor Park, you know, and you said meet the other farmers.
Yeah.
And but even after when the awards were over, to go around the stands, and when you'd read the first three or four stands, like when you read them, we were doing a lot of those things already, like, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
You'd be happy when you'd be reading them, like, you know, what's coming, but we're probably doing a lot of them anyway, you know.
Correct. But it almost gives you confidence, Pat, that you're on the right track. You know, the kind of way.
Exactly,
And there's no harm in that either. You know, that's a positive to get that, like, you know what I mean? To get that reaffirmation that, like, listen, yeah, we're on the right road and we're doing some of this stuff already, like, yeah. Right, folks, that's it for another week. Thanks for watching, and indeed, thanks for listening. Thanks to all our own specialists, and indeed to our NDC Kerrygold Quality Milk Award finalists for joining us. If you want more from Farmers Journal podcasts, go to ifj.ie/podcasts or any webinars, including the webinar from Tullamore Farm this week, where we had the farm organizations in the Tullamore shed. We'll be back again next week. Until then, stay safe and stay farming.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.